the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. The 2014 elections in Solomon Islands brought an intriguing mix of change and continuity. In a public seminar, Development Policy Centre research fellow Terence Wood delved into the election results and looked at what they mean for those working in development. The presentation slides are available on our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
Good afternoon, everyone. We might make a start. Welcome to the Crawford School of Public Policy. My name is Matthew Dornan. I'm a research fellow at the Development Policy Centre. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of land on which we meet, the Ngunnawal people, and paying respects to their elders past and present. Before we begin, I'd like to briefly bring your attention to another event that the Centre is holding this week on Thursday. The Centre will be launching a survey that it has prepared together with the National Research Institute in Papua New Guinea, A Lost Decade, Service Delivery and Reforms in Papua New Guinea, 2002 to 2012. This has taken up a number of years' time of a number of research fellows at the centre, so we're very pleased to have released that report. It will be launched in Australia by the High Commissioner, Charles Lapani, and will feature Stephen Howes and Thomas Webster speaking at that event. Of course, today we're here to talk about the Solomon Islands, not PNG, and more specifically to listen to Terence Wood discuss the 2014 Solomon Islands election and its implications for development. I can't think of anyone better placed than Terence to discuss this particular topic. Terence was in the Solomon Islands in the lead-up to the election. He completed his PhD on the topic of voter behaviour in Solomon Islands as part of the State Society and Governance in Melanesia program. He's been an associate of the Development Policy Centre over the period of his PhD. He maintains a keen interest in aid and development, which is informed by his previous life within the New Zealand aid program. At the centre, we're fortunate to have Terence joining us fairly recently as a research fellow, having completed his PhD. He'll speak for about 40 minutes, I'm told, and then we'll open the floor to questions and discussion. So please join me in welcoming Terence Wood.
All right, thank you. So as Matt said, today I'm going to speak about the 2014 election in Solomon Islands, and more specifically, I'm going to take a look at what changed and what didn't around the election, and I'm going to sort of discuss what I think... I'm going to discuss what I think the changes mean and what they might mean in particular for us, I guess, as aid workers or people here in Canberra interested in development, and what they might mean about the potential for political development in Solomon Islands in coming decades. Obviously, there are elections where we might have expected to see quite significant change. There are elections that were preceded by a new electoral roll, a new legislation passed through the Solomon Islands Parliament designed to strengthen political parties of Solomon, the country's political parties. And when the outcomes of the elections started trickling through, it also became apparent that, at least in some superficial way, they were also very different elections to those that had preceded them. Not only did Gordon Darcy Lilo become the first Prime Minister in Solomon Islands history to learn the hard lesson that he didn't govern by divine right, unlike certain other people, and then he had to win his own seat back and lose his seat, right? But there was other stuff going on more systemically around the country. There were quite a lot fewer candidates standing than in previous elections, and a very high percentage of incumbents won back their seats by Solomon Islands standards, suggesting something akin to a rising form of political stability in the country. What's more, there were many, many more candidates registered with political parties in the 2014 election in Solomon Islands than there had been in previous elections in the country. So on the surface, at least, 2014 really did start, or has really did appear like a different election in Solomon Islands. Yet what I'm going to try and do is argue that the differences that we can see on the surface are actually pretty superficial, and there's no evidence whatsoever to suggest that the fundamental dynamics of Solomon Islands politics have changed around the time of the 2014 election. What I'm going to do, I guess, is structure this talk in a way. I'm going to remind you what the fundamental dynamics of Solomon Islands politics are. Then I'm going to look at what did change in the 2014 elections, elaborate on the points I've just made. Then I'm going to explain why I think these changes are only superficial. And then I'm going to conclude the talk by suggesting what this all means for us and what this means for the Solomon Islands. Before I move on to that, though, I need to start with a few acknowledgements. I don't know how it works for other researchers, but for me, I wouldn't get anything done in Solomon Islands without the help of other people. And I really need to thank some of those other people before I say much more. I need to thank my Kiwi Wontok, Mel Phillips, for all sorts of advice and also giving me a place to stay in Solomon Islands. I need to thank Stephen and the Development Policy Centre for sending me up there in the first place. I need to thank Daniel Evans for allowing his car to be commandeered in the pursuit of election teams through the back streets of Honiara. And I also need to acknowledge the various candidates' campaign teams for sometimes providing me with reliable information about where they were going to be and at what time. Here in Canberra, I need to thank people such as Joe Fukona, Lindsay Penday and Natalie Nahong for their ongoing advice about Solomon Islands politics. And in Honiara, I'm really grateful to Ben Afuga and Redley Raramo for their advice and help. In Malaita, perhaps more than anyone else, I'm grateful to this man here, Beato Fidale, and to his brother Francis and to his wife Christina, who in this visit, as in previous visits, helped me decipher and traverse the electorate of Aoki Langalanga. So, as is always the case, if I get anything wrong today, none of these people are to blame. However, to the extent that I have anything useful to say, they also deserve some of the credit. All right, onto the substance, or at least onto the substance via a brief detour into electoral mechanics. Now, I'm not going to talk about electoral mechanics much because I know that people from the State Society and Governance and Melanesia Program and also the Centre for Democratic Institutions have been studying this in depth and will no doubt be speaking about it much more in coming months. All I want to emphasise at this point in the talk is that, in a nutshell, while there are problems with the way elections are run in Solomon Islands, there's also a lot that goes quite well. And compared to many countries, including neighbouring countries such as Papua New Guinea, elections in Solomon Islands are of reasonable quality, right? There are problems. Vote buying. Here we have a photo of a van owned by a young entrepreneur who's advertising the fact that their vote's for sale. Vote buying is definitely quite common in elections in Solomon Islands. Here we have a photo of a relatively intimidating looking poster associated with a candidate who is, by happy coincidence, a relatively intimidating man, which I thought I'd put up to illustrate the fact that there is quite a lot of quiet coercion that goes on around elections in Solomon Islands. Not everyone gets to choose of their own vocation. And this coercion, I think, tends to follow existing power gradients within communities quite a lot. Women are probably quite often less free to choose than men, and younger people are often less free to choose than heads of households. So there are certainly problems, but by the standards of elections in developing countries, Solomon Islands doesn't do too badly, right? And I thought I'd illustrate this with a photo here. It's a little hard to see, but here's a carload of Douglas Hete supporters who have taken a wrong turn in one of the suburbs beyond Honiara and have found themselves immersed amongst a sea of supporters for a rival candidate. And in many parts of the world, this would be a very bad place to have found yourself in. Right? But here, they've been subjected to nothing worse than a sort of concerted vuvuzellering. That's the correct term. And I just thought I'd put that up, I guess, to suggest that while there is some violence and some coercion and things like vote buying present in elections in Solomon Islands, for the most part, at least what I saw of the 2014 election, suggested to me that things would run fairly well. And certainly well enough that the country couldn't in any meaningful way be described as an autocracy, or that we don't have an electoral politics to discuss and to ask questions about. And when it comes to those electoral politics, just to quickly remind you of what I see as their most central dynamics, the key thing to understand about voter behaviour and the choices voters make in Solomon Islands when they're free to choose who to vote for is that people vote locally. That is, They vote for candidates who they think are likely to assist them personally, or assist their family, or perhaps assist their community, should that candidate be elected into power. Very rarely, this chart, which is drawn from the People's Survey, suggests, by very rarely I mean about 3% of the population, do people vote, make their voting decisions on the basis of governance of the country as a whole, right? So in Solomon Islands, unlike, say, Australia or New Zealand, where I'm from, all politics is very local. And you win elections by convincing people that you'll take care of them at the local level. You do not win elections by convincing them that you'll work wonders for the governance of your country as a whole. And this is a very important point. The other closely related point is that people don't vote along party lines in Solomon Islands. So in the last election, back home in New Zealand, I voted for the Green Party. I have no idea of the name of the candidate who I voted for. That was kind of an immaterial, right? I was just interested in the party's, I liked the party's policies, and that is what determined my voting choice. In the Solomons, it's the complete opposite. People, while parties exist, and while they do play a role in party in electoral politics that I'll talk about in a second, they play no real direct role in determining the way people choose who to vote for. None of this is particularly unusual, right? Political scientists call the type of politics that we see in Solomon Islands clientelism, and it's common throughout the developing world. It's also something that you can find in the histories of our own countries, in the histories of the politics of our own countries. It's also not unreasonable. Solomon Islanders have immediate needs. They live in a very weak state. They live in a country where they've never seen changes in national government lead to any change in the strength of the state that they live in. And so under these circumstances, it makes pretty good sense to do the one thing that might lead to a change in your own personal life, and that's vote for the candidate who promises to help you directly. So it's not something that you can fault Solomon Islanders for doing, but it is something that's problematic because it leads to members of parliament being selected and then incentivised to focus on the local at the expense of the national. If you know that your re-election chances have got nothing to do with how well you perform as in the portfolio as the Minister of Education, you're probably going to neglect that portfolio and instead concentrate on trying to channel into resources that you can return to your key supporters back in your constituency. And that's what goes on in Solomon Islands. Similarly, and in a related manner, because people don't vote along party lines, there's nothing to punish members of parliament should they change their party allegiance or leave the government and join the opposition. Unlike, say, being a Labour Party member of parliament here in Canberra who went and joined the coalition, I mean, if you did that here in Canberra, right, that would be the end of your electoral career. But if you did that in the Solomon Islands, if you left the government and joined the opposition and left the party that you're associated with and joined another party, that really wouldn't matter because people don't care what party you're from. Having said that, parties do exist in Solomon Islands and they do play a role in the country's electoral politics. But that role has got nothing to do with bringing ideologically like-minded groups of members of parliament together or in channeling voters' beliefs about the governance of the country as a whole into sort of political decision-making. Rather, parties exist in Solomon Islands as a tool of patronage, right? They exist as something that enables wealthy political power brokers to take money and channel it to candidates or to members of parliament as a form of quid pro quo for their support when it comes to government coalition formation. And this does provide some sort of party bonding within Solomon Islands, but the associated bonds are very, very weak, right? As is kind of suggested by these two newspaper clippings, or front pages behind me on the projector, they're both taken from the same day. NCRA was the governing coalition at the time. As you can see, there was some confusion as to whether it was going to remain the governing coalition. I think, for the record, it did. But when you have a national politics that is so weakly bounded by party loyalties and so weakly constrained by voter association with parties, you end up with a very fluid national politics. You get MPs shopping their votes around a lot. You see Parliament prorogued for long periods of time as the government of the day tries to stave off no confidence motions. And you see things such as ministerial posts not awarded by virtue of any sort of meritocratic process, but simply by virtue of, or by necessity, as the government of the day tries to buy up the support of influential members of parliament. All of this provides the country with an unstable and unhealthy national politics, which contributes to the very poor governance that it suffers under. It's actually my worst nightmare, sneaking in late and having to walk in front of the projector. So I'm glad you did it so well. I might not feel so bad about it next time when it happens to me. Anyhow, so this obvious problem of political instability contributed to one of the main changes that we saw in the lead-up to the 2014 election in Solomon Islands. And this was the parting of the Political Parties Integrity Bill, a document or a law ostensibly designed either to directly engineer or perhaps more indirectly foster a stronger party politics-based system of political governance in Solomon Islands. It's an act that was legislated but has never been fully regulated for. It's an act that I have to confess I find hard to understand, although I'm definitely not a lawyer, so that could be my own limitation. And it's also an act that appears to be very weak, right? And in a way, I mean, you search through that act, and myself and a colleague have done this, you search through the act and you struggle to find any clause within it that would really dramatically change the nature of party politics in Solomon Islands. And once you think about it a little bit, perhaps that's to be expected, because passing any legislation through the Parliament in Solomon Islands involves getting the support of a good chunk of Parliament's members of Parliament. And in this case, it would require getting a reasonable number of MPs to do something slightly strange, and that is sign away their own leverage when it comes to coalition formation. If you really drew up an act that was going to strongly bind members of Parliament to parties, it would reduce members of Parliament's ability to go up to the leader of any political coalition and say, hey, I'd like to become the Minister of Education, otherwise I'm going to join the other team, right? So passing this sort of legislation is inevitably going to involve some really delicate navigation between trying to convince members of Parliament that their needs are served, well, the needs of the country are served by providing some form of political stability, while at the same time convincing them that their needs as individuals, individual members of Parliament, are unlikely to be neglected by virtue of the fact that they now no longer have this tool of leverage through which they can provide for themselves and obtain benefits from the government of a day. And so, perhaps unsurprisingly, given all that, the Act seems very weak. It didn't seem, at least to my reading, like it was going to dramatically transform Solomon's politics. It does provide for the formal registration of political parties and gives some money to parties for every member of Parliament that they get elected, but the amount involved is paltry compared to the amount of money sloshing around Solomon Islands politics. So, about 4 months ago, I was proudly proclaiming that I didn't think this piece of legislation was going to change anything. Then all of a sudden, I got a little bit of a shock. Here we have a chart. Each of the bars in the chart is an election year, 2010. The previous election, 2014. This election, and the y-axis on the chart shows the percentage of candidates standing in that election who were associated who stood as independent candidates, that is, who weren't associated with any political party. And as you can see, in 2010, which we think is a fairly typical year, about 75% of candidates who stood in that election stood as independents, right? Only 25% of candidates were associated with a political party. But then, all of a sudden, in the wake of the party's legislation, bang, in 2014, only about, I think, 54% of candidates stood as independents. So all of a sudden, there are nearly as many candidates standing as party members as who were standing as independents. And this was kind of surprising, and it at least caused me to think twice. Perhaps the Parties Act was in some way changing the nature of party politics in Solomon Islands and was going to lead to a more strongly party-based politics in the country. And as we got closer to the 2014 election, other changes became apparent too. So in the years immediate, in the previous last two elections prior to 2014, the number of candidates standing, or the average number of candidates per electorate standing, had been steadily increasing in Solomon Islands. Politics in its own sort of sub-electorate way was becoming more and more fragmented. However, come 2014, we saw a quite distinct reversal of this trend, right? All of a sudden, here we had an election where quite a few less candidates were standing, significantly less than had stood in 2010, and less even than had stood nearly 10 years ago in 2006. So something, another sort of strange change occurred and suggested that perhaps something was afoot. Then, once the election results themselves came in, something even more dramatic emerged. And that was a really unexpectedly high proportion of incumbent or sitting members of parliament were able to retain their seats in the 2014 election. This chart shows for every election since independence, the proportion of incumbent members of parliament who contested their seat and were successful in contesting it. There was one other year, 1993, that was a very kind year on incumbents, but on average, about 50% of incumbent MPs lose their seats in any given election in Solomon Islands. Except that bang, come 2014, about 70% of incumbents were able to successfully defend their seats. Once again, this was a change, and a change that perhaps suggested some form of consolidation, a rise in stability of a sort, and perhaps, you know, something that could be seen as a rise of some sort of new form of political order, and maybe something that was associated with the rise in parties, the strengthening of parties, indirectly born of legislation. Maybe, although I think that's unlikely. Well, I've been thinking about it for the last couple of weeks, and I think that's very unlikely. And I think that's unlikely for a range of reasons.
Terrence?
Yes? If it's a hard question at the end, or maybe even afterwards over a coffee, if it's an easy question, I'm happy to take it right now.
I think it's an easy one. I was just going to say on 93, I think that there was an increase in the, significant increase in the number of electorates, which would mean that that apparent anomaly is actually attributable to more incumbents coming back, but because there were more seats to contest.
And they were contesting smaller seats, so it made it much easier for them. That's part of the explanation. Also, 1993 was the first year of the Rural Constituency Development Fund, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a second. So, yeah, 1993 was an explainable outlier, and I guess the task I'll try and set myself over the rest of this talk is to explain 2014 in a similar way. The first point to make, right, is that when you look at a crude binary like success or failure in terms of individual members of parliament defending their seats, you're obviously going to get overly pronounced trends, right? Either you succeed or you don't. But if you use a somewhat more nuanced variable, and what I've done here to do that, if you use a somewhat more nuanced variable, you see much less pronounced trends. And the variable I've used to try and capture the sort of experience of sitting members of parliament in the 2014 election and to situate it against previous elections in this slide is the average percentage vote share of incumbent members of parliament. And once again, you can watch it changing over time, and you can see that 1993, as was just pointed out, was a pretty good year to be an incumbent MP, and 2014 was still a pretty good year, but it isn't by any means an outlier, right? It doesn't stand out. It's not nearly as striking when you look to look at something such as average incumbent member of parliament vote share. What this is kind of suggesting is that a lot more incumbents won, but many of them only won in very close races. And then when you dig a little bit deeper, things get more puzzling still, right? So this chart is a chart which suggests that there's actually no real relationship between the two phenomena I've just described. That is, the rise in members of parliament associated with political parties and the sort of rise in incumbent success rates in 2014. So here, we have a chart that shows for both elections the proportion of re-elected incumbents who were either in red, party members, or in blue, independents. And what we see is that in 2010, most of those re-elected incumbents were members of a political party. More than 50%, about, I think, 65%. However, in 2014, most of the people who managed to win their seats back weren't members of political parties at all. They stood as independents, right? So, despite the fact that 2014 was an election with many more candidates associated with members of parties, and despite the fact that it was a good election for incumbent members of parliament, there doesn't seem to be any relationship between these two facts. Rather, they actually seem to be pulling in opposite directions. We have new parties legislation, fewer candidates and more candidates and parties, somewhat better incumbent performance, but most of the winning incumbents were not from parties. I tried to put that in equation form, however, I'm not an economist, so it didn't end up very good, but my conclusion, I think, is fairly sound. Ha. So what does all this mean, or how can I explain it to you? Well, and I promise I don't have too many more charts to inflict on you. The first of these charts shows for both of the last two elections, shows on the x-axis, it's a histogram of sorts. On the x-axis we have percentage vote shares, right? So here are candidates who won between 0 and 10% of the vote. Here, candidates who won between 10 and 20% of the vote. And it shows the proportion of candidates who fell into each of these categories who are either independents in blue or party candidates in red. And what you can see in 2010, and I guess this is a fairly typical Solomon Islands election, is that most of the candidates who performed really poorly were independents, while most of the candidates who did really well were associated with parties. On the other hand, in 2014, kind of akin to what I showed you before, most of the candidates who did very well were independents, and there was a much more even split between poorly performing independents and poorly performing candidates associated with parties. And I think this is all easily enough explained by some of the clauses buried away in the party's legislation. In particular, the way the legislation was drawn up had a consequence, perhaps an unintended consequence, that if you were elected to Parliament as a member of a party, if you weren't that party's leader or didn't go into the election in a position that was going to lead to you being seen as that party's parliamentary leader, you were inevitably going to have to play second fiddle to the party leader, or the leader of your party, or the parliamentary leader of your party. This meant that you were going to have to follow their decisions, and it also meant that you had no chance of becoming prime minister. So if you fancied yourself as a pretty strong candidate, if you read the legislation carefully, you were kind of going to be incentivized to actually shy away from joining a party. Incentivized because by being an independent, you're in a position where you could remain a free agent. You would have to join a party after the election, it's true, because you couldn't be a member of a formal governing coalition without being a member of a party. But you could do that with much more sort of leverage power, because you weren't part of an existing party's hierarchy, and you were going to be someone that the party would probably really require the vote of if they were to become part of the governing coalition. So by working as a free agent, you'd be in a position to kind of, a much better position to exchange your vote for political advantage during the hotel politics that are going on at present as Solomon Islands tries to decide just which governing coalition will lead the country. Of course, if you were associated with the political party, and there were a bunch of Solomon Islands power brokers and aspiring power brokers who did attach their names to political parties in the lead up to elections, the situation you found yourself in as the election loomed was kind of different. Here, well, you weren't a free agent, you were shackled to the party, at least for a while, and your leverage was best advantaged if you could pull a large number of candidates into Parliament in your wake. If you ended up coming into coalition negotiations having funded and succeeded in having elected five or six other candidates, you're in a much better position when it comes to negotiating with other parties or other members of parliament as to the formation of a government. So what I guess we saw in the lead up to the 2014 election was the formation of three different types of candidates. Strong candidates who were fairly confident they were going to get re-elected, and their situation was best served by staying independent. Then we had power brokers and who were people, once again, who might be fairly confident of being elected but also had quite a lot of money and who hoped to do just a bit more than get re-elected and who wanted to bring in a group of candidates with them. And these people, like Steve Obana, often ended up as the heads of parties. Then we had a third group of candidates who were candidates who didn't have a particularly strong chance, but who had at least some chance of winning a seat. And these candidates in 2014 became quite appealing to the heads of parties, who then devoted some resources, at least, to trying to get them elected. It just turned out that the resources available weren't enough, and instead most of these party-associated candidates ended up faring pretty poorly. There is, and this graph really doesn't have the fidelity to show it, but there's another group of people who performed, the subset of candidates who performed the worst, those who got about less than 2% of votes, a sort of category of their own, the no-hopers, and parties did askew them in 2014 and in 2010. But you have more of a middle group around here who had some chance of getting into parliament and so ended up being hoovered up into parties in the hope, at least in the eyes of party leaders, that they might be able to improve the leverage of the party and the power brokers of the party by serving as a bloc in parliament. However, this really wasn't an effective strategy, and rather it was the independents or the incumbent members of parliament, the people who were confident they were going to get elected, who decided to stand as independents, who won the day in 2014. And when it comes to explaining incumbent survival, this is also something, the somewhat higher than usual success rate of incumbent candidates in the 2014 election in Solomon Islands, this is also something that's fairly easily done, right? Turns out there's a pretty strong relationship between average GDP per capita growth rates and incumbent performance, be it survival or vote share, over time in Solomon Islands. That is, when the economy is performing well in Solomon Islands, sitting members of parliament do well. And the reason I think why this is the case is because when the economy is performing well, everyone has a bit more money in their pockets, so the material demands on sitting members of parliament are not as acute as they are when the economy is performing poorly, but also it means there's more money sloshing around in general, which means that if you're a powerful person, and I guess by definition most members of parliament are, you're going to be able to tap into that money to use it for patronage purposes. So, averaged since 2010, the growth rate, economic growth rate, is over in Solomon Islands between 2010 and 2014, averages at over 5%. So it's been a period of pretty good economic performance. Certainly it's been a period where there's been a lot of logging money sloshing around the economy, and therefore I guess it's been a period that if you've been able to tap into this money, it's been a good time to be a politician, because you can spend that money within your electorate in a patronage kind of way, and that will definitely help your re-election prospects. The other thing is that government money available to members of parliament to spend in their constituencies more or less at their discretion also increased dramatically over the period of between 2010 and 2014. I won't get into this in any detail, but in 2013, every member of Solomon Islands Parliament had about $800,000 or $850,000 to spend at their discretion, more or less, within their constituency. And given that the average Solomon Islands constituency is pretty small, that's a lot of money. Now, it's not an unqualified benefit for members of parliament. Lots of stuff can go wrong. Voters aren't stupid. Often they know just how much money they should be receiving and begrudge members of parliament when they receive less. And certainly in the past, MPs have always had access, well, since 1993, have had access to funding akin to this, right? And it hasn't helped them that much in winning a re-election. However, the fact of the matter is that between 2010 and 2014, it just rose so dramatically, it would be remarkable if it didn't have an impact on incumbent survival rates. What's more, in 2014, just before the close of Parliament, MPs awarded themselves some sort of severance grant, right, that gave them a nice little tidy portion of cash to spend on their campaigning. And in elections in Solomon Islands, right, it's a strongly clientelist polity, vote buying is very common, money really does help. So if you're looking for a reason to explain why incumbents did quite well in this election, the answer is pretty simple, right? They served over a period of time where there was a lot of money flossing around the sort of broader economic environment, and they also served under a government that did its best to dispense to them good amounts of cash which they could spend in a patronage-type way in their electorates. And this was pretty helpful when it came to being re-elected. And so I would say, upon these facts, I kind of hinge my claim that I don't think, despite the sort of superficial changes we've seen in the 2014 election in Solomon Islands, there's really been any change to the fundamental of Solomon Islands electoral politics, right? I think electoral politics remain as patronage-based as ever. I think party politics remain as patronage-based as ever. I don't think the legislation has had any real direct effect on how parties operate. I think that members of parliament still tend to move in and out, will still tend to move in and out of parties, and parties will still tend to move in and out of coalitions on the basis of perceived electoral and material advantage. And I think that voters will continue to keep voting as they've always done in search of localised material support. And I really don't think the legislation's changed that, and I don't think that the sort of I don't think that the superficial changes we've seen in election results are suggestive of any change in these underlying dynamics. I will add a caveat to that. I don't know, and once again, I guess with Hannah, who's sitting up the back there, we did puzzle over this for several hours once as we read through the political party's legislation. It's possible that the Act will have some devils lying in its details and there'll be some unintended consequences. It's possible that there are clauses in the Act that might make it harder for parties or individuals to leave governing coalitions, or that at least might make it easier for governing coalitions to replace anyone who withdraws from them, which might lead to an increased level of political stability over the following political term in Solomon Islands. But at least I'm not confident of enough of my own ability to read this Act to be able to say that's certainly going to be the case. And so what does that all mean? I got prude and censored one of those words. I don't know whether in the Crawford School we tolerate swearing. But this is some graffiti that was written on the wall of a betel nut stall out near the KG bus stop on the way out to Henderson Airfield, just outside of Honiara. And I thought I'd put it up there. It gives you a sense, perhaps, of voter disillusionment in Solomon Islands. And while there were festivities associated with the election, and while there was a lot of good-natured engagement with this election in Solomon Islands, you could also sense amongst the average Solomon Islander a real underlying weariness with the way the political process there continues to fail to deliver good governance to the country. And with this weariness, I guess perhaps exists an ongoing underlying risk of conflict, perhaps not the sort of ostensible ethnic conflict of the tensions, maybe it'll take some other form in coming years, or perhaps just a lapse into criminality, as we've seen in parts of Papua New Guinea. But it's very hard to look at the degree of continuity in the problems of electoral politics in Solomon Islands and the way that thinking about the way that electoral politics are associated with problems of governance more generally, and how that in turn translates into an absence of development opportunities for the average Solomon Islander. It's hard not to think about all that and not be somewhat pessimistic about the country's future. On the other hand, Solomon Islands also possesses remarkably resilient social institutions, and Solomon Islanders themselves are, I think, an underappreciated fact of Solomon Islands society is the inbuilt sort of peace-building institutions that exist on a local scale. So the worst-case scenario is not inevitable, but certainly there's nothing to believe that we're going to see some sort of transformation of the quality of formal government in Solomon Islands anytime soon that will lead us to a position where ourselves or where Solomon Islanders can relax and feel like the country's on a much healthier development trajectory and that it's not still in danger of lapsing back towards some form of conflict. So what does that all mean for us, sitting here in the luxury of a vaguely air-conditioned room in Canberra? Well, I guess I think there are some important lessons in terms of how we think about the last 10 or 15 years and what we've learnt about our engagement with Solomon Islands electoral politics. And the first of these lessons, one could arguably argue, starts with downerism, as I call it. And this was a period of sort of engagement with state building in the initial years of Ramsay and Solomon Islands that was very engineering oriented, right? For the most part, it seemed as if the aid world viewed the problems of governance in Solomon Islands as being something that could be solved more or less through capacity building and a bit of technical assistance and some mechanical engineering of institutions, and things would be happily ever after. This didn't last forever. And it's not as if there was no engagement with the political. Obviously, Alexander Downer, from time to time, ventured into the Solomon Islands political space. But even as we started to broaden our understanding of Solomon Islands political governance and political governance, I think we probably have to concede that we've learned just how impotent as outsiders we are when it comes to changing the central facts of Solomon Islands' political economy. Despite the fact that aid is about 30% of Solomon Islands' GNI, or it has been in some years, despite the fact that Solomon Islands is a small island developing state, changes, for the most part, are not going to come from without, right? They're going to be born from within. It's not to say there's no role for external assistance, but I think we need to think very carefully about focusing that role on key institutions that need to be held together and on working smartly and working with the grain. Second key point, right? Sometimes, and you could certainly hear this in discussions in the wake of the last election in Papua New Guinea, I think we in Canberra are too prone to getting caught up in tales of goodies versus baddies when it comes to potential candidates for the Prime Minister in the countries in question, in this case Solomon Islands, right? Here we have the two people whose names have been put forward to the Governor-General, and one of whom will become Prime Minister, presumably at the end of tomorrow, Manasa Sogavare, and the other chap from Isabel, Jeremiah Manele. And I don't know, you may have your own preferences on who would be a better or worse Prime Minister for the country, and certainly the country has had better and worse Prime Ministers over the years, but by and large, I don't think the individual personalities matter that much. And I really don't think we should get too caught up in trying to evaluate them. Because even if you get the ideal reformer, Rick Ho, someone like that, as Prime Minister, they've still got to play the game. They've still got to buy up the support of wavering members of Parliament, and they've still got to get re-elected in their own constituencies, usually by buying votes or delivering patronage-type goods, right? Personalities matter, but the underlying fundamentals of political economy matter a lot more, I think. Similarly, if there's one lesson that I'd like to leave with you all from this talk, I don't think there's that much scope for institutional engineering to solve the problems of politics in Solomon Islands. And the main reason that that's the case is that legislation gets passed by Parliament, right? And anyone who is in Parliament at any given moment in time, by definition, got there by being able to navigate the system as it currently is. It's unlikely that that sort of person will vote for a system that is dramatically different. Why would they vote away a system which has served them quite well? I think it is going to be very rare, it will be a very rare instance where you get any sort of legislative change to the way a country's politics or elections are run that is going to transform into better political governance, for the simple reason that the people who are going to have to pass a law to make that change are also the people who are benefiting from the existing status quo. And then finally, and more optimistically, I think the greatest potential for change and healthy change in Solomon Islands politics lies in the emergence of new civil society organisations. I've just chosen Forum Solomon Islands International there because they're kind of intriguing, a Facebook group. Whether this particular organisation will take off, escape from Facebook into the real world, is still an open question, and I'm not suggesting that the road ahead for them will be easy, but they are interesting because they represent an attempt on behalf of Solomon Islanders, granted, educated Solomon Islanders with access to the internet, or at least with access to smartphones, to try and engage in a form of collective action that the country hasn't really seen before. A form of collective action that revolves about trying to hold politicians to account for how they perform in governing the country as a whole. And given that I think that the main problem with Solomon Islands politics is the very patronage nature of the politics the country experiences, some form of collective action seems a necessary condition to me if the country's ever going to move to a healthier form of political governance that prioritises the welfare of the country as a whole over just sort of individual needs or local needs. That's where I'll stop. I'll just finish with one note of warning. Bodo Deke here has a number. This is a sign that Bodo Deke put up. He's the Member of Parliament for North West Guadalcanal. You drove past the sign as you drove out to the west of Honiara. It was a sign confidently proclaiming that 3,592 people had pledged their support to him in the lead-up to the election in 2014. But poor old Bodo only won 1,724 votes. So I don't put the sign up to poke fun at Bodo. I imagine winning elections in Solomon Islands is hard, but just to say that we all get things wrong. And I am still puzzling my way through the results of the 2014 election, and I could be wrong with what I've just said here, and I'm open to being corrected if you think I'm wrong. I'm certainly open to having ongoing discussions as we try and think further about just what's happening with Solomon Islands politics, what's changing, what isn't changing, and what might change things in the future. For the meantime, though, happy to field your questions.
Thank you, Terrence.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.